Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic.
Larry.
Thank you, Steve. I was expecting a little more than that. But the song I would like to sing would be called Comfortably Numb by Pink Floyd. Never trust a Mexican when they're behind you. I'm sorry. He's not Mexican. Anyway, I'm glad to be with you guys, and I want to thank the great 10-minute speaker. That was fabulous. And I want to thank my buddies from Scotland for coming over here with me, Davey, Eric, and Lindsay. Thank you guys for following me over here. And I want to welcome the new guys. And I know there is one of you that's fairly new because you were outside the men's restroom. And I asked you how you were doing, and you said that you were a little nervous because you didn't know it was a men's banquet. And I asked you, what gave it away? And then I told him, if you think this is bad, wait till the dance. We'll start with the slow dances first. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for close to 30 years and not amount to a goddamn thing. So I don't know what you think you're doing if you're new, but the highest I've ever gotten here was sober, basic human being, active member of my own home group. And that's as high as I need to go here, you know. I'm the type of alcoholic that's got a busy head. I got a head that loves to chat. And no matter how tired I am, that little head loves to chat. And I could be physically beat, like I was last night. Around 2:30, boy, that old head just, hey, let's chat. I know you're in there. Let's talk about when you were a baby and bring you right up to date, for God's sake, you know. And the frustrating part about that is we just did it the night before, you know. They don't care, you know. And I like to worry just to see how God did with the shit that I gave him all day, you know. And I heard that there may be some rain, so I started worrying about the rain, you know, and thinking about all that water. And, you know, what happens to the water in the pool? Does it flood over? Does it go underneath the house? You know, where does that water go? You know, does it go to my neighbor's yard? You know, I'm worried sick about it, you know. Because I don't own a pool. But I'd think about getting one, and we're going to work on that for a while. I come from good people. And I was born in Detroit and come out to California when I was about 3 or 4 years old. And put in a little foster home for a while and finally got out. And my mom's a great lady. My mom's a little Scandinavian lady, and my mom loved diet pills. She was always running around the house around midnight, sorting out nuts and bolts all night, you know, or raking the neighbor's yard around 4 in the morning, you know, and no matter what time you got up, she was up doing something, you know. And she used to eat that speed and make these Afghans, you know. And we had a small house, and you can hear her in the little room all night just going to town, you know, and making Afghans, and everything in the house had fresh Afghans on them. You know, the chairs had Afghans, couches had Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had a little poodle head she knit and stuck them on there, you know. And if there was any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And just a busy lady, you know. And I knew she loved me. Her favorite hobby was to eat that speed and make these huge jigsaw puzzles, right? These 30 million piece jigsaw puzzles of the Mojave Desert. You know, she'd get all excited, you know, it's going to be a beige night tonight, honey, you know, and come running down to Stavon's and getting her, you know, this buy these big puzzles and buy her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because she saved the coupons on the back to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught in, you know. She was my first tweaker I ever met, you know, and she used to eat that speed and make these puzzles, start smoking, and if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers and just snipped that son of a bitch down, you know. And I loved my mom to death. I loved hanging around her. And isn't it amazing what would happen when I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous and take a fourth and fifth step with a guy? And what I would do at an early age, starting way back then, and follow me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and sometimes afterwards, is what I would do with people who would give me love and attention and affection. And it started with her. I would play her like a fiddle. That there would never be a time too inconvenient for me not to put the touch on that lady. Never. And I never want to forget what it's like to be a young man in high school and be put away for a little while, and you're supposed to come back home and you're supposed to show up on a Monday, but you don't show up on a Monday. You show up on a Thursday. And you don't show up at home. No, you show up at that lady's place of business. And it's a little dry cleaners over there in Torrance. And she works at a dry cleaners and she cleans people's houses, and I'm ashamed of her. But I'm not too ashamed to waddle into that parking lot at 9 o'clock in the morning with that rain hitting me. And my mom's about from here to that wall, and I'm just staring at her. And the only thought that I have is she better have a buck. And I waddle through that rain and go into that lady's place of business and one more time startle her with my presence. And without skipping a beat, I ask her for that money. And she opens up that little wallet, and a picture of me falls out when I'm 8 years old on a Little League team. The only decent picture she'd ever have of me till I met you guys. And without missing a beat, she gives me that $1, then $2. And then I grab that money and I run off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me tonight with you guys is you take the same man and you bring me to a room of Alcoholics Anonymous with my so-called desperation and willing to go to any lengthness. And you stick me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where every action that I take, my life depends on. And I need to ask you something if you're new. How come when my life depends on it, if you were to put the secretary of this meeting that same distance as me and my mom in that parking lot, how come when my life depends on it, I can't walk that same distance and ask a man for a job in a meeting that's going to save my life, but I can walk that distance and use my mom and other people like her time and time and time and time again? And I'm here to share with you, if you're new, and it's only my experience, that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will, make no mistake about that. Which is why it's necessary for a man with close to 30 years to still have a home group and a job in it. Not so that I can run off to Costa Mesa and brag about it, but because of one thing and one thing only if you're new. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. There is no place. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And I never want to forget what it's like to be going to all these meetings all through Southern California and stare through your windows and look in these meetings and wonder if I'll ever have a chance at this thing. Will I ever be in the middle of you guys? Or will I always be on the outside looking in like I've had my entire life? And if I can find that ingredient, that defect of character, if you be, that keeps me from serving AA, if I can find out what that is, I will have found the key to life. Because once I began to serve you, I could not keep it from bleeding in every area of my life. You can't stop it. There is a miracle here. And once I began to serve the thing that I expected so much from, I began to see why these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous were so important for me. And if you're new, I hope you find that thing that keeps you from serving us. Because that will hold the key to life. Because you can't keep it from bleeding in every area of your life. And there is nothing more powerful to a sponsor than to watch some selfish son of a gun come into AA and begin to serve just a little. And you know, goddammit, that guy's got a corner of the star. And I love seeing that in AA. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. He loved to drink and sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing, man, you know. He was an old window climbing alky, which is, I think is a lost art in AA, man. Those old windows. Any window climbers in here? There is nothing like sneaking into that damn window, and you better make sure that it's not the bathroom. You know what I mean? And make sure it's your own home. You know? I've banged on windows for an hour and ain't even my place, man. And man, I got, you know, my dad had these big refinery boots, and I remember one night he got drunk and snuck in there. And I could tell because he was stepping right on my chest that he was coming in there. I grabbed that boot and I said, "Dad," I said, "why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys? You know, my God, she's up anyway." You know, I can hear the Hoover going now, you know. And that old man was so disappointed in me. He knew I was a loser. You know what I mean? And he didn't trust me. You know, I remember being small and I wanted a pet. So he got me an ant farm. You know what I mean? Why don't you try that out for a while, you know? But I was always running around seeking his approval. Man, I always wanted the old man's approval. Ever since I started doing disapproving things, really, you know. But I wanted that guy to like me, man. I wanted that old man to like me. And for years, I used to think it was because I loved him. Not till I met you guys in Alcoholics Anonymous and took that inventory. I wasn't seeking his approval because I loved him. I was seeking his approval because I was afraid of him. See, I heard what he was doing to my mom in the middle of the night. And I didn't want that to happen to me. And when you're a little kid around 4 or 5 years old, I started beginning not to trust these people that I was supposed to be loving. I didn't trust my mom because she's letting this happen. I didn't trust the old man because he's doing this. And I had this tremendous amount of guilt and shame because I ain't stopping it. I ain't saying nothing. And along that time of year, my dad come into my bedroom and he says, "You're going to have a baby brother." And I start planning for that kid brother. I start saving up those baseball cards and oiling up my glove and thinking about taking him to the beach and the drag races. And 9 months later, my dad come into that bedroom and told me that my baby brother died. I don't remember having any compassion or concern for my mom. I did what I always did when I didn't understand something. I got mad at it. I went after the old man with all 60 pounds, started yelling and throwing my arms at him, told him that he promised me. And that would become one of the things on the top of my inventory, is how ashamed that I felt. But what that did to a young kid at about 5 years old is put this tremendous amount of fear in me, and that is, what type of God would create a baby and kill it? I don't want nothing to do with this thing called God, Jesus, Jehovah, whatever you want to call it, religion, nothing. And I became closed-minded to anything along those lines. And I knew that at an early age, it was up to me to figure things out. I can't trust them, and I'm feeling guilty about that. I can't trust this thing called God. And at 11 years old, I had so many questions. And I knew it was up to me to figure it out. I had to come up with my own answers. And I've always felt kind of restless and irritable and discontented. And I got this fear, this ongoing fear. Yet I can do everything that all the other guys are doing physically. I can show up and I can do all the sports, and I was good at running and all that stuff. But when I would get home, it seemed like everybody else was able to grasp and develop a manner of living and push through life and carry on. And I feel like I'm dragging an anchor. I feel like I got weird stamped on my forehead. I know something's wrong with me and I don't know what it is. But I'm always wondering what's wrong with me. My whole life, that was the ongoing question. What's wrong with me? And sooner or later, people started asking me the same thing. You know, what's wrong with you? You know, and I don't know what it is. But I'm always in doubt. And the only thing that I ever brought into life was guilt and shame. I don't care what room I was in. That's the only thing I ever brought. And about 11 years old, there was four of us in a garage, and we started passing around a bottle of Four Wharf whiskey. Nobody had to talk me into it. Nobody had to coax me into it. Nobody had to dare me. Hell, it was the only thing that ever came natural to me my entire life. I took a shot of that Four Rose whiskey, and I, for the first time in my life, I stepped into the most peaceful window that I've ever climbed through. And it shut off that busy head. And it shut off all that noise that I was telling about myself, good, bad, or indifferent. And it took away that little confusion. And for the first time in my life, it gave me a sense of well-being. And I've never had a sense of well-being. It made everything all right. And I knew I had an answer. I had something to even out that playing field. Now, I didn't head out to Skid Row the next day and lose my paper out and run into AA, you know. But I never forgot that spot that I stepped into. I had the most fantastic night of my life at 11 years old. Threw up several times, laughed so hard with these guys. Looking at naked pictures, I kissed my first Latin woman that night. It was my aunt. You know what I mean? But went after her, you know. And I loved it, man. And I woke up the next morning and I thought the old man was going to light me up, because he was always lighting me up, you know. He was the only guy that would use weapons on me, you know, boards, tire tubes, you know. And I thought, man, he's gonna string you up. He didn't say a thing. He didn't say a thing. The only thing he did was he locked his bar, put a big old padlock, you know what I mean? He knew what he had in the next room, you know. And like I said, the older I got, the more I leaned on it. And I'm the type of guy who's, besides being an alcoholic, I've got a 5-inch belt of lazy ass that straps around here. I mean, I'm the type of alcoholic who's so lazy, I wake up thinking about my nap, for God's sakes, you know what I mean? And the old man hated that about me, because he was one of these guys, he was a hard-working guy. He's the type of guy that used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it. Well, God damn it, back when I was your age, we really had it tough. And he's absolutely right, no doubt. He had a hell of a time growing up in the Depression and pre-World War II, you know. And his only thing in life was that he wanted to marry my mom and start a new life, you know. And his father died at a young age, choked on his tongue in a convulsion. His mom hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. And he only wanted a good life for his family and everything like that. But I've never been strapped with gratitude. Hell, I got to be beaten half to death today to think about the good life I have, you know. And the old man was always, you know, that just a lazy son of a gun. He knew I was a loser, and I just took that right turn after I drank. You know, just sign me up for the minimum. I want to do as little as I can and get by, you know what I mean, and make that work, you know. And the older I got, the more I leaned on that stuff, and it's not like it was hard to get. The old man had that Thunderbird wine and white port all over the garage, and had some of that old Taylor whiskey in the garage. And, you know, the older I got, the more I leaned on it. And by the time I got into high school, kids were going to their locker to get their books, and I was going to my locker to take some barbiturates to take away their shakes. I didn't think nothing about that. I'm a freshman in high school, and I start dating this little Mexican girl, and she had some brothers, and they love cars, and always love cars. To this day, I love cars, classic cars. I love going to the drag races, and I hung around these guys, and we used to get our Chevys, our 62 Chevys, and drop them right down to the damn ground. Get our hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, get our white T-shirts on and black khaki pants, and drive around and listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck last week, and the Four Tops came on. I just start sinking in my damn truck, man, you know. I loved it. The women were telling me that men who are well endowed had big feet. I had a pair of 15-inch shoes I was driving around in, you know. Big hair, big feet, big ideas. I got Loopy sitting next to me. She curls her hair with these big soup cans. The noodles are still stuck in there, you know. We're driving around, drinking that wine, got our frowns on because our asses hurt from driving around all night, you know. What are you looking at, you know? Now I know. I ran into a kid like that up at Glendale. I was up at the Glendale Mall. This kid comes walking by me. He's got his earlobes drilled out. Do you imagine that shit? What do you want, the 3/4? Boom, you know. He's got his ears drilled out. I think they ought to make rims for those things, some spinners or something, you know. Put a clock in there or something, you know. Circle in a triangle, something, man, you know. But he's got these big old holes in his ears. He's got a ball bearing in his forehead. He's got a ring in his eyebrow. He's got a ball bearing in his nose. He's got a ball bearing in his tongue. Got a tattoo around his neck, chained to his wallet. He goes walking by me and he goes, "What are you looking at?" I said, I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at, man, you know. And we started talking, and now I sponsor the guy. Lived down in Chula Vista, Ron, you know. And I remember when he was new, man, he used to call me up, man. "What do you want me to do?" And I says, "Well, shit, Ronnie." I says, "Why don't you unlock yourself, for God's sakes, man, you know?" "Well, I go to these meetings and I feel so different." "Really?" I says, "Maybe you're the only one wrapped up in a chain link fence, kid. How about that, you know?" You know. And, you know, whenever you start sponsoring guys, you usually get these guys who have your defects of character times 10, right? And sure as stuff, man, that guy, he was just a lazy ass just like me, right? He didn't want to go to work. And I told him after about 60 days, I says, "Look at kid, I says, if I'm going to sponsor you, you're going to have to get a job. We're self-supporting and, you know, I don't care what you think about the Navy and all that. I said, but, you know, you need to get a job, kid, and, you know, and that's it. Well, you know, he called me up about 4 weeks after that, and the excitement, man, it was just, man, you know, you could just see his little tail wagging, you know, and he's telling me, oh, Sponce, I got my job. I said, that's great, kid. That's excellent. I said, what are you going to do, Ronnie? Well, he said, it's only part-time. He said, but 2 to 3 times a week, I go down to the sperm bank. And I don't want to bring him down, but I could just see the excitement on the little guy's face, you know. Every morning, you know, making his own lunch, you know. Wrapping his carrots, you know, and, you know, throwing his glove in there, you know. Grabbing that Hustler magazine and just heading out to that hands-on job, you know what I mean? Just, God, I loved it, man. And so I started bouncing around with these lowriders for a long time, and I loved it, man. I loved it, man. I remember one night me and Loopy were drinking that 151 rum, man. Boy, you talk about stepping into a room. Shit. We were drinking that 150 rum all day. We're drinking that stuff, man. Finally, at night, she says, hey, why don't you pull into the jack-in-the-box and let's go talk to the puppet, you know, like he's real, you know. Come on, Weddle, let's go talk to the puppet, you know. And I'm kind of a lonely guy, so I'm all, and I've been drinking all day, so I'm seeing hundreds of puppets. Just hoping I can find the real one, you know. Pull up into the jack-in-the-box, you know, and I hear that, can I have my order, please? And I just run them over, you know, the old puppet's head hanging down, you know. The cops come, they arrest me, they throw me on the hood of the car, shatters my hair all over the place. I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal. There's nothing like drinking and riding shotgun. Let Rudy drive all night, man. I'll ride shotgun. I'll just drink and look at myself in that mirror. Because you want to get an alky's attention, put that mirror in front of him, man. You, my God, are you good looking? You know? You shouldn't even be hanging around these Mexicans. You ought to be an underwear model, you know? You don't wear any, but what the hell, you know? And you look at yourself in that mirror and, you know, your hair is all big and flat because you've been sleeping on the window. You got 30 pounds of tamale puke on your chest, you know? And I feel like dancing when I look like that, man, you know? Sure enough, we go bouncing off to the Shanghai Reds or Leonardo's or something, and we're going to go find our salsa queen dancer, you know, because I love to dance. We pull up to that bar, and I get excited, man, when I can hear that music, just boom, 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 you know. And we pull up into that bar, and I go walking in there, you know, and way in the back, I see my salsa queen, and she's a knockout, man. Her hair's all big. She's got flies stuck in her hair. She's got some tamale puke on her chest, you know, and she's back there gnawing on a pickled pig's feet, you know, and I like that about a woman, you know. And I got to go talk to her, so I'm making my walk, and my feet are so big, I feel like I'm skiing. I'll be right there, honey, you know. And I finally make it back there, you know, and we start throwing back shots, and about 10 minutes into talking to her about the night we're going to have in my single wide trailer, you know, her lesbian girlfriend comes over and starts beating the snot out of me. Get the hell out of here. And bam, you know, she just knocks me out. And my feet are so big that they're stuck between the foot rail and the bar and I can't get out. And I'm like a boxing doll. I keep coming up and she just bam like that, just nailing me, you know. And I had no idea I was a victim of gay bashing that night, you know, but she kicked the snot out of me, you know. And I'm loving life, man. I knew that me and Pooch and Loopy were going to bounce off into the sunset forever. My alcoholic life, I didn't know was an alcoholic life, was the only normal one I had. See, I had no idea until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous that all those things that we talk about happening to us when we drink, the way it makes us feel, and the quieting of the head, and filling the holes, and making us this. I had no idea until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and started talking to you guys that all that wasn't really happening. That it was a delusion. And that for so many years that the only peace of mind that I ever have wasn't even really happening. But to the alcoholic of my type, it was the realest thing I knew. And whether it wasn't really happening or nothing, it was the only peace that I'd ever had. You see, because I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety drives me to drink. The longer I stay sober, the worse I feel. And there was always people around me saying, my God, if you just don't drink, everything will be all right. And I don't drink and everything is not all right. And the longer I drink, the worse I feel. And I come to these meetings and watch these guys with these ties on saying stuff like, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you. You know, and I'm going, God, I came in with that guy, you know. The only thing that not drinking has ever done to me is squeeze out this insane idea that maybe this time it'll be different. I've never gotten any hope out of not drinking. I've never gotten any encouragement. Everything wears off. But you see, I'm a loser. How does a loser ever get hope? How does a loser ever work through stuff? See, my dad was that kind of guy who started things and finished them. He had that certain something that when the shit hit the fan, he was able to push through that. I'm not like that. Whenever I'm faced with any type of difficulty, working through it never comes to my mind. Don't threaten me with a 401k. I'm out of here. You know, I just, staying and working through stuff doesn't come to me, man. And I don't have that. But you see, I never think of alcohol as being a problem. See, for losers, the only way that a loser ever gets hope is what? He starts over. There's nothing that brings hope to an alky like me more profoundly than starting over. There is nothing like the hope of a fresh start. This time it's going to be different. New PO, new hotel, everything's good for 90 days, man, you know. And nothing ever stays the same. And the longer I don't drink, the worse I feel. And I know that this is a mistake, man. I can't stand it. And they get these insane ideas. Around 1969, a bunch of people are going to Vietnam and going places. And I thought, well, what do I do? And me and my buddy thought we'd go back to Detroit and find my roots. And we wound up in Phoenix. And we're over there at the Apache Hotel off of North Central and Roosevelt. It's about six floors. Everybody's got a TV. It's in the lobby, right? Everybody's got a bathroom. It's down the hall. And I got this little room that I pay $30 a month for, and I don't have the dough. And I got a little window about that size, a little small window. And I just peek down, look at the wagon wheel bar, and I drink and I dream and I die. And I know one of these days it ain't going to be like that. See, now I'm starting to have these ideas. Now I'm starting to see these guys drive by me and I can see their lunch buckets. And I begin to entertain this idea that maybe if I would have some type of normal life, that maybe my drinking wouldn't get so wild. And I begin to entertain that idea that maybe some type of normal living would maybe simmer me down and my drinking wouldn't be so much trouble. And isn't it amazing that when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, to the untrained eye, it seems like that's what happens here. People come to AA, they stop drinking, they get a car, they get a hotel, they get a job, they get somebody to dance with. And to the untrained eye, it looks like your treatment for alcoholism is normal living. And there can be nothing further from the truth. We got guys sitting in this room right now who couldn't fit another car in their driveway. And yet they're restless, and they're irritable, and they're discontent. And they're sitting in the answer wondering what the answer is. You don't need to come to AA to get those things. That just takes hard work and good fortune. But the solution to my malady will be and always will be me, you, and the perpetuation of this gift. See, if you're new, there's nothing to get here. There's nothing to get here. You don't even get sober here. You can do that around your toilet. Alcoholics Anonymous is now, what are you going to do now that you're not drinking? Would you like a brand new way of life? There's nothing to get. In fact, if you're new, the only thing you're going to get here is be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, you know, because this is the longest thing I've ever done against my will my entire life, man, which is why it works so good. It has nothing to do with comfort and convenience. In fact, people like me and you have to do the uncomfortable to get comfortable. And isn't it amazing when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, the things that we are able to go through now that we are sober? And Bill talks about that on 13 and 14. He talks about that there will be certain trials and low spots. He's telling you. And I would get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and have these childish, unreasonable demands on sobriety and AA. That it would shield me from life's little bullets. That I would step into this wonderland of life and everything was going to come my way. You know, these just irresponsible ideas that a loser has like me. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, You will hear guys talk about the things that they handle. And you will be able to go through them with your buddies and your sponsors. The death, the loss of jobs, the loss of wives, the getting more wives. You know, all these things you'll be able to go through. My biggest problem in sobriety is the good life that you've given me. Be aware of the good life. It takes more guys out than anything I know. It's killing people. They get this good life and they get these things that they've always wanted and they finally got it all going materially, and it just blinds them because the thing that saves their life is so far down on that ladder. It's just too busy to get to anymore. And they'll come and they'll take their cakes and they will tell you about their blessed wife and their blessed degree and their blessed life, and yet they're home hanging themselves with their great blessings because they forgot to come back to the place that blessed them when no one else will. This isn't about getting. There's not a damn thing to get here. The thing that Bill and Bob are hoping that happens to you is in that 12th step. That you will be inspired, that something will happen to you, that you will be inspired to carry the message. That's what they're hoping will happen to you. They're not hoping you get a job and a car. I love that little picture of the two guys and the guy on the bed. Do you think they're telling him you got to work more overtime, Omar? See, Bill was laying in that bed. Bill was laying in that bed and his childhood buddy came by to him and he started reading him these proposals. And Bill looked at these things and they started discussing some of these things. And Bill had that wind through the window and the light and all that. And for years in AA, I used to think, that's the spiritual experience. That's the thing. And little did I know that until I got into that book and listened to you guys, that the spiritual experience was in the next paragraph. He knew he had to work with another alcoholic. That's what they're hoping happens to you. That you'll be inspired to carry this message. What type of spiritual experience is it that doesn't include carrying this message? It's just another selfish, self-centered idea of mine. He's hoping you'll be inspired to tote this message. Not from here. Speakers are the easiest thing to get. Down here where we need you. Down here in the meetings. At home. That's where we need guys. We need coffee makers. We need guys setting up these chairs. See, and I'm inspired to do that because you blessed me with a life that I know that maybe I got a chance to recreate that atmosphere that was created for me. And I have that chance by making that atmosphere happen again. Setting up some chairs and making some coffee. And how many of you guys remember when you knew that first guy that stuck his hand out to you and said, "Hey, my name is Bob, I'm an alcoholic. How you doing, kid?" You remember that? You remember your first 30 days, what it was like? I hung on every word you guys said, man. Every word, man. I don't ever want to forget what it's like to be new. And I'm over there in Phoenix, and I'm in that little room, and I don't know what I'm going to do for dough. So I go down to the Wagon Wheel Bar, and I meet this guy named Ernie. Ernie's from Tennessee, and Ernie says, "I know what we're going to do for money." He says, "I got a buddy that's a plumber. Why don't you come down here the next day? We'll put you to work." And I met Ernie, and he met this buddy, and he took me out to Phoenix, and they stuck me underneath the house. He says, "All I want you to do, kid, is hang copper." And he gave me a transistor radio, and he took off. I got a pint of PM bourbon. I'm underneath this house. I got this bourbon. I got this transistor radio. I got this stray cat over there looking at me. Dawned on me, shit, I'm on top of the world. I got it made under here. I mean, nobody knows I'm under here. I like that sneaky thing, right? You know, and you know, I got a pint. I got a transistor. I got a pet. You know, my life is getting, you know, all I got to do is bang on that pipe every now and then, you know, and man, this calls for a shot of hot bourbon, you know. Throwing that bourbon back, 9 hours later, they're dragging me out from underneath that house, you know. Got drunk, busted up through the floor, robbed the lady of all of her money and jewelry. They're pulling me out of the house. That cat comes running out with a necklace on and shit, you know. Get fired from that job. Go back to the Wagon Wheel. Meet up with Ernie. Ernie, I know what we're going to do, son. I know what we're going to do. He says, "Not too far from here is a horse track. We're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey." All right, I'm thinking we're going to start working out, running, you know. And he gave me a bag of speed. And I don't do speed. I've been just drinking wine and doing heroin, minding my own business, you know. And I'm not going to be no Afghan maker, that's for damn sure, you know. No. You just take the stuff, and I'll come back in 2 months, and we'll go weigh you in. He was sure it was working. Hell, he was 102, you know, like that. So he took off. The son of a bitch comes back 2 weeks later. I haven't moved an inch in my little room. I've just, you know, just been chasing a fly around in my room, you know, and looking out the window every 10 seconds. What's that? What's that? What's that? You know, and seeing these black and white flashes. That was the damn sun going up and down, you know, and running around this room. Anything that was white, I'm just lighting anything that's on the ground that's white. It could be a toenail. It's going up, man, you know. Worst 18 days of my life, you know. And you couldn't have possibly taken all of it. Well, I do. Then you can put a saddle on me and ride my ass around here, man, you know. So we canned that idea and went back to the bar, found another plumber to work for, and worked for that guy for maybe, I don't know, 2 hours. And then I found out he was younger than me, and I ain't working for a kid. You know, I've got my pride. So I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury and sent me down to the county hospital. On the way down there, got me a little half pint of bourbon, went to the county hospital. The doctor wrote me a prescription for Percodan, and then he left me these boxes of prescription pads he wanted me to have. Take those things. Running down Central Avenue, duck into the Wagon Wheel Bar. Ernie makes a call to Tucson. He knows some guys down there, and we start writing prescriptions and selling them. Write prescriptions for Secanol and Nembutal and Tuinol and you name it all. We wrote it all, you know. And damn near took it all, too. And after 9 months, they caught up with me. Now, when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase. You know what I mean? There he goes down the 405. Look at that bastard go, you know. None of that was happening. I was going 9 miles an hour. The cop was walking by my car. Goes, you want to roll that down, you know. So they put me away for a short period. I'm no big-time convict either. I'm just a loser, which is Greek for quitter, you know. And that's what I've been doing. That's what a loser is. I've been quitting ever since I was 11. I know how to quit better than anybody I know. I quit things and I haven't even started them. Just the thought of them wears me out. You know, no, I ain't going to do that shit, you know. And isn't it amazing what happens to Alcoholics Anonymous and a sponsor and a couple commitments? How this thing, this routine that we live in, this routine that people make fun of us for having, you're not going to another meeting, are you? Isn't it amazing how the alcoholic finds such a sense of security in those 3 or 4 meetings a week? Those ones, those no matter what meetings. That's the power of a home group. There's nothing more sad than to see a guy who's sober and crazy and wondering where he should go tonight. Should I go? No, I ain't going to Fullerton. No, I ain't going to Costa. I may as well just stay in my room and work this shit out, you know. Been here 5 days already. What's another night? You know what I mean? But there's nothing more secure than to be sober and crazy and know where you're supposed to be in 2 hours. Sitting next to those bastards you can't stand. And before you know, you give them a ride home. I love my home group. That's where I learned everything I know about being a man. I used to think a man was somebody who was loud and vulgar. I had no idea what a man was till I come and hung around men in AA. You know what men do? Men give cakes. Men hug men in meetings. Men love their sponsor. Men love this thing that's saving their life. There is nothing more useless than a useless man. There's nothing more sadder in God's eyes. And we become to become useful here, have a purpose. What a sense of security that is for a guy who's been lost his entire life. Knowing where you're supposed to go and what you're supposed to do. We're in good hands here. We're awfully good hands here. And I didn't know that as a young man. Had no idea. And the older I got, and then Dr. Bob starts talking about this frightful drinking. And we know what he's talking about when he talks about frightful drinking. When everything in that guy knows that it ain't going to last any longer. But you're physically so bad that you got to have a shot. That you're shaking and your hallucinations and the blood coming out of places and the way that you're turning into is just so bad that you've got to have a shot just to shut your head off. just to quit the shakes, the nightmares that you have, and the music and the ongoing convulsions, just a shot to start the day. And then there comes a time in the alcoholic when everything in him wants to get sober. That he doesn't want to go through it anymore. And this frightful drinking when that guy is crying in the alley, drinking, and he doesn't want it. And the tears are coming down my face as I'm drinking that Santa Fe port, and I don't want to do it anymore. But I don't have the power to stop it. And I'm like a tail on a kite. It's just a matter of the wind hitting me. And little did I know that when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, that this kite was going to have a string on it finally. That I may be a kite in the wing, but you guys weren't going to let me fly around unattended. That because of Alcoholics Anonymous, that there was hope for a guy like me. And I had no idea. I'd never had any hope. And the sad part about my life wasn't that I was thinking about dying or suicide attempts or should I jump in front of the bus or just jump off the cliff. Those weren't the sad idea about my life, and some of the folks is here, is I knew that I was going to live and going to have to keep doing this shit again and again and again. And I didn't want to do it anymore. I didn't know what to do. And so in 1974, they sent me out and they brought me back to California. And I signed up over there at downtown L.A. and I got a probation officer. And in 1974, they put me on antabuse. And I'd never been sober for a long time. And I'm sober for about 2 months on this antabuse. And I get this little janitor job over in El Segundo, and I take a bus over to El Segundo, and I got 2-3 hours before I'm supposed to work, and I don't want to do, so I go into a Little League dugout. I go into this Little League dugout, and I start daydreaming, and I slip in between hysterical and maniacal. My paranoia becomes so tight that my hallucinations begin to come back, and they stick. I become somewhat catatonic, and I don't know what to do, and somebody told me that they called the paramedics, and they came and got me out of that little dugout and took me to the Harvard General Hospital over here in Torrance. And they looked at my jacket, and they seen some of the things that have happened to me over the years, and they said, well, I think you need to go to a state hospital out by Oxnard for about 30 or 60 days and be observed. And they sent me out there, and a year later, I came out of there, totally observed, you know. Well, we couldn't find anything in there either, you know. And they gave me certain medications to take for certain conditions. But there's one thing that you can't medicate away in an alcoholic. And that is this insane idea that maybe this time it'll be different. And in 1975, I run out of Thorazine and they find me out on Overall Street, curled up like a dead dog at the Chevron gas station. A public nuisance. I'm curled up like a dead dog and they sent me up to Wayside for a couple months. And they bring me down to the South Bay Courthouse in 1975, and I'm going to be sentenced to 2.5 years in the state penitentiary. And I'm in this holding tank about half the size of this room. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everybody's gone. All the buses are gone. All the other guys are gone. I'm on a concrete floor with a Vons bag and no hope, wondering where they're going to send me now. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Scottish guy with a patch came into that little jail and he said, "Hi, lad. Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Come with me, son. We're going to AA." And I thought, "My God, what's that? I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA, you know? And who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? Hi, lad, you know, is he real, you know?" Looking back well over 30 years, I know exactly what he is because we got a handful of them here tonight. He's what we honorably call a trusted servant. Now, what made that man a trusted servant? He wasn't a probation officer. He wasn't a counselor. He's a refinery worker. But you see, he had no business being there. He wasn't on a panel. He wasn't part of H&I. He was a refinery worker who got the worst news of his life. And he knew his wife was in bad shape, but he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. He knew he was in a terrible spot. But somewhere in his home group, somewhere in his book study, maybe somewhere in his men's meetings, the man was to be able to sit quietly and grasp and develop a manner of living that ingrained in him this. Practical experience tells him that nothing will ensure immunity than intensive work with other alcoholics, that this works when other activities fail. And that guy took his little Chevy and turned it around and went to the South Bay Courthouse and talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth. And they said, I think we got a guy for you. And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. And he put me in his little Chevrolet, and I thought I'm ready to go up north and maybe have some lunch or something for a long ride. And he takes me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that car, he tells me the news. He said, son, I know you've had a tough life and you feel different. By golly, if there's anything I've ever felt, my entire life was different. I've always felt different. Even coming around AA, I've always felt different and able to prove that I am. He said, son, I know you've had a tough life and you feel different. He said, I can't wait for you to meet these people. I can't wait for you to meet these people. He says, son, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, don't you worry about feeling different. In fact, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are. He says, nobody comes here happy and well-adjusted. That's for damn sure. And the man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. And he bounced up to this dirty, stinky, rotten, smelly, pukey, just a goofy little thing called a Torrance Lamita Alano Club. I thought, what the hell is an Alano? Is that like a Samoan bar or something, you know? A watch for crossing Alanos, you know? And sure enough, he pulled up to this Alano Club, and there they were. All the Alanos were walking around, man, you know? Everybody had a nickname and a tattoo, Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and, you know, Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt, all these other people, you know. I said, my God, I just left a group of people like this, right? And little Moose comes running across park. Hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are. I'm not it, you know. And some transvestite came out of the card room. He starts circling me like a helicopter in Norwalk. And after about three times around, he lands, and this guy comes walking up to me with this transvestite with his muumuu on, and he says, I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting. I said, I don't think so. Not till I get my year anyway, you know. I said, my God, that guy's got big feet, you know. I said, my God, if that's AA, I don't want any part of it. And if that's the effect of that blue book, I don't want to crack that thing open either. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the biggest lie that I was telling myself. I hadn't touched AA. And that don't make me a worse alkie or a better member. All that did is teach me that if I don't change, my sobriety date will. But you see, nothing changed. I'd been doing what I've been doing my entire life. I sat in a room waiting for people to do something for me. I sat in a room waiting for something to happen to me or people to do something for me. I've been doing that my entire life. I've been sitting in rooms at the state and county waiting to get checks and hunks of cheese and bus ride tickets. I've been doing that my entire life. And that's what I was doing here. And little did I know that what I was waiting to be done to me, God was waiting to do through me. It was up to me to start doing things. There's nothing to get here, but there's so much to do. I get so tired of people telling me that AA don't work. AA don't work. AA doesn't work for me. AA doesn't work for me, Larry. Well, I got news for you. It doesn't work for me either. Doesn't work for Scott. Doesn't work for Peter. Doesn't work for Lindsay. Doesn't work for John. Doesn't work for Tom. We work for it. We work for it. It's time for me to do something about this thing that I want so bad. And I had no idea what was happening. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, every time I called Central Office, they would send this Montana cowboy down. And he never asked me, hey, aren't you the guy that robbed the Hawthorne Alano Club? You know, no matter if I was in the alley or in the hotel, he would ask me that one question, are you ready to go to a meeting, kid? And he'd take me to you. In 1980, I'm over in Wilmington at the Don Hotel. I'm on the third floor. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning. I got a hot plate and a hot TV. I'm watching Jeopardy, so I can really feel like an idiot, you know. Every now and then I get one right. Donald Duck, you know. Yeah. I don't need no college, you know. 10 o'clock in the morning, I hear this. Larry, it's Don. I go, my God, it's the guy from AA. I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here, you know. Opens up the door. My God, Larry, you had 15 days. You were going to be a janitor. What's going on, kid? And I took that bourbon and I said, all the pride, the false pride that I could muster, I said, Don, I don't want what you have. I don't want what you got. If I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do. Why don't you get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do? The cry of this alcoholic my entire life. It'll be a cold day in hell before I get a man a cup of coffee in an AA meeting. Shot me back to 1967. Me and the old man are fighting. He's kicking me out of the house at 15. Selling dope and drinking. You want to do that, that's your business. But I got a wife and two daughters. You're not doing it here. Went after the old man again. Shot me back to 1972. Sneaking up on my mom. She's over in Torrance. About 1 o'clock in the morning. I sneak in her room one more time with my drunken mud. Startled her half to death. She puts my head on her lap. And she starts rocking and praying to this Michigan God. Please help my baby boy. And I've got my head on her lap. And I can feel the tears hitting me. And the only thought that I have is, Mom, it ain't going to be that bad, I tell her. It's not that bad. Everything's going to be all right. Why don't you go off to bed and I'll be okay. And she takes off down to bed and she goes in the hallway. And it dawns on me that the old man has a half a pint of white port underneath the garbage disposal. And I start looking for that half pint and I can't find it. And I start tearing up her kitchen. I start tearing up her medicine chest. I wake my mom and she comes down the hallway. She says, honey, what's wrong? And I start banging around my mom till I get blood out of her nose, demanding that she come up with that bottle. And she had no idea that it was there for me to pass out and to wake up in the morning to see that the empty was already in the trash can. I drank it. I never want to forget that, what it was like before I met you. I never want to forget that. May 2nd, 1982, I'm at the Beacon Light Mission in downtown Wilmington. I just go by these windows at the Woolworth store and I look at myself and I'm 120 pounds and I'm yellow. I got everything I own on my back and I've been living on the streets for a long time and I lock eyes with the thing and I hadn't locked eyes with him for a long time because I look in mirrors and I don't look in reflections and I most certainly don't look up. I've got my head locked in the down position. There ain't anything in me that wants to look up. There ain't anything in me that's any ounce of being a man. And I look up at this reflection. I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? And it dawned on me, I never had a dream. That the only thing that I've ever lived for and the only thing that I've ever ran my life around was maybe this time it'll be different. And I looked at myself and I did what I always did when I got that way. I panhandled some money and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And who do I get? I get Don. I get, Don, this is Larry. I've just checked into the mission. I'm ready to come to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty ass down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love, you know? And I just heard it. And for the first time in my life, it was up to me to come to you. It was no longer necessary for the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous to be inconvenienced by my nonsense. And at that morning, at that moment, I went into that alley around that phone booth and I came to believe. And I did not come to believe in God. And I did not come to believe in AA. But I came to believe in the hopelessness and the futility of my life at that moment. And that I knew that even though I was in the gutters rolling around with the pigs one more time, I knew that that moment would not be enough to keep me sober. And it frightened the hell out of me. Because I've been down there before. And I'm not one of these drunks where the memory of their last drunk keeps them sober. In fact, the memory of my last drunk is pushed away by the pain that I feel when I'm sober. And I knew I was going to get drunk again, and I didn't want to do that. And I walked that 10 miles with my poopy pants and no hope to that Alano Club. And I asked that man something. And every step of the way, my head saying, you ain't going to make it. You little loser, you've really sold yourself a pile of poop. You've never made it and you never will, Larry. Duck into here, crack that window and get that bottle of wine like you did before. You ain't going to cut it. AA ain't the answer. And I told my head to shut the hell up. And all I could think about was Alex and seeing Don at that club. Because I knew I had to ask Don something that I never asked him before. I got to ask him this question. And I made it down to that club. And they said, you can't stay in here. You've been thrown out of here. I said, I just need to talk to Don for 5 seconds. They said, well, he's in the back. And I walked up to that Montana cowboy and I asked him something I never asked a man in AA. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? That was the hardest thing I've ever asked a guy to do. And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds. Then he lit into me for 20 minutes, man. And he gave me the wood. Yeah, I'll be your sponsor. He says, but one thing, Larry, I don't ever want you to debate what I ask you to do. I'm not here to argue what I tell you to do. I got guys that want to do this thing. I'll do whatever I can to help you stay sober. You just follow me. And I followed him. And I gave him everything I could. And that guy was my sponsor for 2 years. And I changed sponsors. Finally got a home group, never part of a home group. Started taking these steps. Started making amends to people, paying money back. Started getting together with my mom. A lady that had nothing to do with me. I knew it would take more than an afternoon and a lunch. And on May 2nd, 1982, I took my last drink, I hope. And I started making amends to people. And my mom wouldn't hold me for a long time. She wouldn't hug me or nothing. But I wanted that lady to have some peace of mind finally, because I'd robbed her of it so many times. I'm a happily married man for close to 14 years. But I cheat on my wife every week. I date my mom. I go over there to Torrance and I spend time with her. And not too long ago, she was in the hospital. And she had some intestinal work she needed to be done and ulcers and stuff. And she was worried to death. And my sponsor said, for God's sakes, why don't you go over there and encourage her and tell her everything's going to be... Get the hell out of yourself, Larry. She's scared. I said, all right. So I went over and talked to my mom, you know, and I told her, hey, you know what? It's going to be like getting your tonsils out. It's going to be nothing to it, Mom. Everything's going to be all right. And I'll be there the next morning and, you know... I really felt good about myself. Well, she goes and has this operation and it goes south. They find all kinds of stuff in there and they really have to lay her out and do some more things. And I go back the next day to visit her. And I got my little flowers and I go up to her room and the nurse says, are you Betty's son? And I go, yeah. She goes, she wants to talk to you. My mom's laying flat on her back. She's got all these hoses and she gets her head up and she goes, like that. She waves me over. I get my head down by her mouth and she goes, tonsils my ass, you know. But on the way up there, I talked to my wife and Rosie says that women like to be massaged. And I thought, you know what? I'll massage her little hands or something. I'll get her some cream. And I got this big jar of lavender hand cream. And I went up to my mom's room and I'm looking at her and talking to her. And I see how she's dry and those hospitals get you that way. And I look at her feet and I said, Mom, I says, how would you like your feet massaged? And boy, those feet came out of those covers and they just start, you know. She says, I would love it. And I took a big gob of this lavender hand cream and I started massaging my mom's feet. She's going, oh, ah, scared the shit out of me, you know what I mean? And then it dawned on me, you know, when I was a kid, I was a dirty little kid falling out of tree forts and shit. And she would always rub that Cornhuskers lotion on me. But something else dawned on me. That was the first time that ever touched my mom. It was the first time I'd ever touched her. And I realized that I never wanted to hurt her again. And that along with making amends to her, for the way that I was living, you guys had taught me that Moms always blame themselves for your life, no matter how good or bad it is. They still own a little part of that. That's part of being a mom. And I didn't want my mom to blame herself for anything that happened to me before I met you guys. That my drinking and my running the streets had nothing to do with her being a bad mom. And you guys let me do that with some amends. Now I still see that little lady. In fact, I seen her last week. She's over in a little retirement place over there in Torrance. It's about 6 floors high and all the ladies got balconies. And all the other ladies, I noticed, have real flowers on their balcony. And I'm sitting at my mom's place and realize that she's got plastic flowers on her balcony. And I said to myself, you chump. All these other ladies got real flowers and your mom's got plastic flowers, man. I says, Mom, I'm going to get you some real flowers for your balcony. She says, I don't want them, honey. I said, no, you don't have to pay for them. I'm going to get planters. I'm going to get you some roses and I'm going to take care of them. And you're going to have real flowers. I don't want them, honey. I said, no, Mom, you don't understand. I'm going to get them. I'm going to build a flower. She says, Larry, I don't want any real flowers. She says, I love to sit in my rocking chair and watch the hummingbirds suffer. You got it. Everything that I know about being a decent person, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And all these amends that you guys told me to do, and there's some amends that we fight tooth and nail. But I'm so glad that we follow through with one of them. Now, when I was 5 years sober, I got my first marriage of my life. I married this little lady, and it lasted for a whole year and a half. And the divorce happened, and I had to leave a little girl who was 2 years old. It was the hardest decision I've ever had to make. And the men in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, you may not be somebody's husband, but you'll always be somebody's father. Don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at. If you can fly off to Ohio and talk, that you can go over to Arizona and visit your little girl, what's more spiritual? And this is what you're going to do, Larry. Every 2 weeks, you're going to write that little girl, and it ain't going to be on yellow paper. It's going to be on Pocahontas paper. And you're going to drive over there every couple of months, and you're going to take her on a daddy-daughter date. And you're going to take her to those places where she can paint her own coffee cups and make her own ashtrays. And you're going to spend time with that little girl. And there'll never be a couple months go by where you don't see her. Now, I've been doing that for 14 years. Because for a while she lived in California. And the last trip I took over there, she was 23 years old. It was just here recently. And I'm having the daughter-daddy date, and I'm sitting across from my daughter, and she's got her mom's earrings on. She's got a ball bearing in her eye. She's got a ring in this eye. She's got a ball bearing in her nose. Got a ball bearing in her tongue and a tattoo around her belly. And she says, what are you looking at? I said, the most beautiful little girl I've ever seen in my life. And we started talking, and she says, Daddy, I need to talk to you about something. I says, what's that, honey? She says, well, there's a guy that I love. And I says, that's great. She says, and I've been with him for a while, and I really love him. She says, but there's a glitch. And I says, what's that? She says, well, he's been divorced a while, and he's got a baby daughter who's 7 years old. And I says, really? She goes, yeah, and he was over last night, and he started crying. I says, why is that? She says, because he's afraid that she's going to forget him. And I said, well, what did you tell him? She says, it was pretty easy, Daddy. She said, John, you don't have to worry about that little girl forgetting you. What you need to do is write her every 2 weeks. Take her to daddy and daughter dates. And bring her to those places where she can make her own coffee cups and ashtrays. She says, you do that every month. She says, that little girl will never forget you. I almost missed that. I almost missed that. There were so many times I wanted to turn that car around. And I met the jackass not too long ago. And we were talking, and I said, John, how you doing? And what kind of work do you like to do, John? He said, well, I want to be a rapper. That just tickles the shit out of me, you know. I said, you want to be a rapper, huh? He says, yeah. And I says, well, okay, try this on. Put your hands in the air like you just don't care, you know. And, you know, get your ass out of here and get yourself a real career is what I told him. Well, I tell you, that guy's a heck of a guy because I've gotten to know him. And my little girl's in good hands. And she's never forgotten me. I've got the good life here. We've all got the good life here. And yet it could be so dangerous if we don't take care of the thing that gave us that good life. We've got a beautiful banquet here tonight with friends. And my sponsor had a very close friend. And that friend used to talk about the carpenter all the time. And Chuck always used to talk about the carpenter. And not too long ago, I was in a room out of state somewhere, and I read this story about the carpenter, and it reminds me of you guys. The carpenter told this peasant, he says, I want to have a banquet. And he says, I want you to go into the city and find out everybody who was poor and maimed and now saved, and bring them to my banquet. Now go out there, peasant, and get them. And the peasant went into town, talked to the blacksmith who was once poor and maimed and now saved, and he said, the carpenter's having a banquet and he wants you to show up. And the blacksmith said, I've got a herd of horses to shoe. I'm too busy. Tell him I can't make it. So the peasant went deeper into town and he went to the cobbler, who was once poor and now saved. And the cobbler said, I can't go to the banquet. I've got an army of men to shoe. Tell the carpenter I'm too busy. He went further into the town. And he got a hold of the farmer who was poor and maimed and now saved. And he says, the carpenter's having a banquet for you because you're saved. Could you come? And the farmer says, I've got crops I've got to put up. Tell the carpenter I'm too busy. And the peasant came back into town and went to the carpenter. And he told Jesus, he said, where are all my people that were saved? And the peasant told him this. They were all too busy. They were just all too busy. And the carpenter told him, you go back into town and you get a hold of every person who is poor and maimed and bring them here and let's feed them. And you tell those folks who were saved that they will never again eat at my banquet. You guys threw me a banquet tonight. And every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, we throw a banquet. And I'll never forget the people who were here when no one else would have me and welcomed me. In 1935 in May, a stockbroker and a doctor got together in a Cyberlean guest house. And that doctor says, I'll give this guy 15 minutes. That's all he's going to get. And they came out 3 or 4 hours later. In that house, they had a moment. They had a moment. They had a moment that never happened before, where for the first time in my life, and the first time in that doctor's life, that guy came out of that little meeting and he says, he understood my drinking. He understood what I was going for. And the beautiful principle of identification was born. This is our Cyberlink guest house. Every time you show up to your home group, every time we go show to present in our meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's our Cyberlink guest house. Let's never forget this moment of identification. Let's never forget why we're together. And let's never get spoiled by our great blessings. I am not a very spiritual guy. I know very little about God. All I know is this. That on a Saturday night in Costa Mesa, I see table after table after table of guys who should be locked up dead or insane. And look at us tonight. Look at us. We're happy, we're joyous, and we're free. I don't ever have to worry what he looks like or what he sounds like. I've just got to make sure that I come back and play in his evidence. Thanks a lot, you guys.